Thanks, Rob. So yeah, if you came looking for a non-specific abdominal pain as advertised, you're going to be crushingly disappointed, and I'm sorry. So I'm going to talk through our year in Arizona in the pandemic. And so I'm not going to talk to you about how to treat COVID or all of our treatment protocols, all that kind of stuff that we've been doing. What I really want to focus on is us, right? Our workforce, our team. So one of the things, I love photography. I don't know that I'm particularly good at it. This is not my photo, but this is a photo that was getting passed around quite a bit on social media back in 2020. You know, there really aren't any iconic, I don't think there's any iconic photos that have come out of the pandemic, right? Many big events in our history have that, like you see it and you instantly associate that. And part of it's because, you don't go around photographing in the hospital early. But there's a number of them that I find quite moving. I'll share a couple of them through this talk. This is one of them. I just think this is the prototypical nurse. You don't need any context to see this, to know what's happening here, right? You've been in PPE for hours, you're exhausted, and it doesn't look like someone who's broken to me. It looks like someone who's, exhausted and tired, but ready to go, right? This is the classic, to me, ED nurse, although I think this person was actually critical care. They're in the same boat we are. But anyway, we've been through a lot. It's been a hard year. So what I want to talk to you, or hard 2 years, what I want to talk to you about is a project where we followed our healthcare workers through a year of the pandemic. We're actually going to do another swipe at this in July and get the end of the second year. So I'll just kind of talk you through what we did. So we're uniquely at risk for COVID, right? I mean, you inherently believe that because we're working in the hospital, where all the sick people go, and if anyone's going to get COVID, it's going to be one of us, physicians and nurses, staff in the hospital. Right, so everyone early on, we didn't know what was happening. People come in, they're dying. You don't understand how this is really transmitted. We're arguing about whether it's droplet or airborne or what that even means. And it was a tough time. And early on, and working in kind of bridging administration and working in the ER on the front line, I'm well aware everybody wanted to know. Did I have COVID? Do I have COVID? How do I get tested? Testing was very tough to come by. So that was a big dissatisfier, I would say, for our staff in Arizona in March and April of that year. Looking at this from the study perspective, right? The hospital environment offers a natural experiment. You've got people who are right up in people's faces all day, every day. You got people who sit in a back office, right, and never see a patient. Wouldn't be able to pick one out of a lineup potentially, right? So, but they're all in the hospital, right? So you've got a natural experiment right there that you can look at what happens with varying degrees of intensity and duration. So in April, Abbott came out with the first antibody test, right? First serology test, and it happened to run on the Architect platform, which is what we had throughout our entire system in the Phoenix market. I got the bright idea, like, hey, this would be something we could do for our healthcare workers, right? Like, maybe we can start testing them and answering that question. Hey, I don't know if this is a correlate of immunity or not to have positive antibodies. We don't know that yet. We think it probably is. We don't know what it means, but it's something we can actually do for them, right? So we cooked up this Proving We Can Torture acronyms in emergency medicine, just as good as a cardiologist. We have the CONSERVE study, so this is a COVID-19 seroprevalence in healthcare workers. And we started in May, or conceived this in May of 2020, try and follow the serology of our cohort of our healthcare workers over a year of the pandemic. We naively thought would be the year of the pandemic. So the side benefit obviously was the antibody testing. Getting these things funded is tough, right? Who wants to do this? So this was, fortunately, because I was in a quasi-administrative role at the time when this started, I was able to sort of advocate this with the hospital presidents, and they all agreed this would be something they would be willing to pony up for. And they ponied up in the form of simply paying for buying the test, right? They're not going to charge our staff to get tested. So that was a big chunk of this. But there's a lot of other work that went into it. Where's all the personnel going to come to draw blood, to manage this? You're trying to get informed consents from a gazillion people and manage that process. We wanted to do a wellness survey. That's time-consuming, right? So we got funding out of our foundations to do this, and additional funding that came from the hospitals beyond just the we're not going to bill sort of in-kind funding that they gave us. So the core hypothesis that we started with was the patient-facing healthcare workers were more likely to or will accrue IgG antibodies to COVID at a higher rate than non-patient-facing healthcare workers. Very simple study. So who was eligible? Everybody in the system. So we have about 12,000 employees in the Dignity Arizona hospitals, and that included medical staff, independent medical staff, employed medical staff, and of course all the physicians, or the all the nurses, any ancillary personnel in the hospital, anybody who lived in the hospital, right, including me. So what you were consenting to was 5 quarterly blood draws. So we had to draw 1 and then every quarter, so you ended up with 5 when you got the 1 at the end of the first year. And everyone agreed to having their samples biobanked because we didn't know what we would do with them in the long run, right? There's going to be more tests come out. We have 1 test right now. Surely there'll be more things to come. And so that proved to be valuable as time went on. We collected demographic information. Again, early in the design, it was like, what's high risk? We kind of know obesity is a big one, so you get enough information to be able to calculate a BMI, and of course age and comorbidities, any history of immunosuppression. We collected their any known COVID events they'd already had, and along the way each time you would ask what was the interim changes, right? Had you had a case of COVID? You ever tested positive? Did you have symptoms before it tested? Those kinds of things, and then a wellness inventory was done each time. So we broke some new ground, and kind of from research perspective, I thought this was valuable certainly for our area, but it was a good lesson. So this is a massive thing to manage, and what we ended up doing was to try and do it electronically. And we had been using REDCap for probably 5 or 6 years now to manage research data, but it's manual entry, right? You get data and you put it into REDCap, and that's where it lives. Okay, so here we did direct entry, so we managed the informed consent process in REDCap. You managed the wellness surveys in REDCap. The only thing that was entered manually into REDCap was the actual lab results that were entered back up, and those were batch uploaded. So it was enormous time and, frankly, cost savings with doing that. It's the first time the IRB let us do an informed electronic informed consent, which we've used extensively since then over the 2 years doing COVID studies and other studies now. So the electronic data capture was a big deal. And then who's patient-facing and not? So this was an arbitrary, sort of groups we put them in, but basically physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, phlebotomists, rad techs. Anyone who gets in the patient's face, right, for any significant amount of time is patient-facing. And if you were not in those groups, you were non-patient-facing. And that we refined that pretty tightly as we went through and assigned everybody. Because, you can be an RN, but you're the chief nursing officer of the hospital. You are non-patient-facing, right? So there's tried to, eliminate as much of that slop as possible. And I think we did a reasonable job of that. A little word about the assay, and this one's still widely used around. So the Abbott Architect IgG, it's chemiluminescent assay, and it is marketed as a qualitative test, a yes or no positive negative test. And they use this cutoff of... you can't see my little green thing, but 1.4 signal to cutoff ratio. Anything more than that is considered positive. Anything less than that is negative. The good news for us about this was, even though it's not marketed as quantitative, that is a quantitative number. It's just an arbitrary unit, but it is linear, right? So a value of 1 is half the antibody concentration of a value of 2, et cetera, right? All the way up and down the line, it's really quite linear. So that let us get quantitative IgG levels, which was nice. And then we just did Z-score tests at each time point, to assess the primary endpoint we're looking for. And then the other important piece of this, which better to be lucky than good. We didn't know what would happen with what kind of vaccines would come out in May of 2020, right? And there's many candidates. So this happens to be, the assay that looks at anti-nucleocapsid IgG. So it is not impacted by vaccination, right? So we were able to keep a true look at who was actually getting a COVID infection even after the vaccination campaign began. So that's the Abbott Architect assay. The perceived wellness survey, I won't spend a lot of time on this. we're still in the process of analyzing some of this and figuring out how to move forward. We've got some interesting things here. But so the reason for the choosing this one, it's well validated. It's not widely used, but it's well validated. But it's not really normative. It's intended to longitudinally look at your feelings about yourself, right? So and the sense early on in study design was, you know, this the world has changed. What does it even mean to have a normative wellness survey against, you know, something that was taken 6 years ago in some college population, right? So this is a way to follow individuals linearly over time. So that's why we chose this. It looks at six domains: psychological, social, emotional, physical, spiritual, and intellectual each time. And it's pretty well put together because there's reverse answered questions and things, right? Because you can't just go down and circle 555, you know. And although I had a couple people who did that on me, So it was a pretty good deal, and as things evolved, I'm really glad we put that in there. So results. Here's kind of the overall what we got. So I told you we have between 11,000 and 12,000 healthcare workers. We had, and the way this went out was just a blast invite to everybody in the system and all the physicians on every medical staff in our system in the Phoenix market. Basically email, you know, click this link if you want to do this. Here's how you sign up. All the information is in there. The informed consent's there. If you have questions, call this number, and you'll get one of the core study people, right? And very few phone calls. I mean, everyone just like, yep, I want to do this because I want my antibodies tested. That was a large part of what I think we got. So we had 1,811 people who actually opened a link in REDCap, 1,736 that actually, you know, went all the way through and signed an informed consent. So the way this worked, in order to keep it simple, was once you did your survey, then you got another invite for here, come get your blood drawn at time X at point Y, right? Different hospitals did it differently. Some had like a Google, you know, some Google sign-up sheet where you're like, hey, here's your days. You can come get your blood drawn. St. Joe's did it a little differently where it was more of an assigned thing. Here's when your times are, and they were only open certain hours. But so every hospital would let them do their own logistics. But at the end of the day, it all went back to REDCap and how you did this. So, you know, I was hoping we would get a couple thousand people, then we might be able to keep 1,000 for the whole time. So, you know, that we didn't quite achieve that, but it was a reasonable keep, I think. So we had 1,309 people that had their blood drawn on the first round. We had 797 that in July. You could miss some, and logistical things came up, like I have COVID right now, and it's time for my blood draw. Well, no one wants your COVID, you know, excreting, you know, butt in the hospital, so stay home, and you miss this draw, right? And so you have people that miss draws, people that just, you know, they're out of state or out of whatever, they just weren't around, or they didn't get around to doing their appointment. So we didn't kick people out for missing a draw. So we had people that had 5 draws, 4 draws, 3 draws, 2 draws, right? And, of course, we had some just actual attrition along the way. But at the end of the day, I had 714 people that had all 5 blood draws, which was a nice keep for that, you know, staying with it that much. And we had 1,399 that had at least 1 blood draw. And of those people, over the year, we had 298 or 21.3% that had at least one time they had a positive IgG, right? So basically a fifth of the workforce had a natural COVID infection over the course of this year. That's what that tells you. So I'll walk you through this a little more so you can get a little more detail on this. But this is the heart of the, you know, the original why we did this study. So the first draw actually occurred in July of 2020. And on that draw, the light bars are the non-patient facing, and the patient facing folks are the dark bars. And so 9.7% and 7.3% respectively had COVID antibodies at that point in time. And that was already statistically significant at that point, right? As you go on to October, you see it went to 12.6% and 9%, a bigger spread. The vaccine campaign began in late December, and we had an enormous COVID surge in January. That was really Arizona's biggest one. Dr. McKenzie was there for that one, right? So, yeah. And here's where you see the split gets big. So we had 22% and 15.5%. We had about 80% vaccine uptake right away in this cohort. If you looked at our healthcare workforce, when we surveyed for the mandates that started happening in, you know, July, August, we were around 72%. So, you know, not shocking that a group of people that would sign up to do something like this are probably a lot more engaged and likely to want to get vaccinated. So we saw that here. But what you see is, you know, the accrual rate, you know, drops off dramatically after the vaccine campaign, right? So the patient facing 23%, 23.8%. and non-patient facing continue to go up. The gray bar here is not meant for direct comparison, but just as a guide. So this was Arizona. This was the Arizona prevalence, okay? And that was, even that's not really prevalence, really that's the number of people who tested positive in Arizona, right? So it's not seroprevalence, so that's an underestimate. I guarantee you that's an underestimate of what it actually was. But at every point, you know, the healthcare workers were far above the what appears to be the Arizona cumulative case rate at that point in time. So here, what about, say, 14% of Arizonans had had a positive COVID test at some point in the last year. Whereas, you know, the healthcare workers are up here. But again, that's an underestimate, so I wouldn't take too much from that. So when you do a subgroup analysis of this is where I think it gets kind of interesting, and this was a surprising result to me, but I think it makes sense. So here are the non-patient facings, again, are the blue bars. We did, this is not a subgroup, that's just one, you know, that's the same thing I just showed you before. The orange is patient-facing that aren't nurses, okay? Yellow is nurses, and the gray is physicians, okay? So the so basically the patient-facing group is split into three tranches, and the, you know, the walk away from this is the physicians act like non-patient-facing in our data set, okay? So they accrued at a significantly lower rate than nurses or non-patient-facing. So why would that be, right? Are we just better at masking and taking care of ourselves, or maybe we don't spend as much time in front of the patients as all these other people do? And I think that's exactly what it is, right? A nurse that's the cumulative air time in a COVID room for any of those other people is probably substantially more than for a physician. So that was an interesting finding out of that and a somewhat humbling finding, because we always think of ourselves as the, like, you know, I'm the guy who's going to get COVID. I'm on the front line. And, you know, the front line people are the one who are in there, you know, cleaning up, you know, cleaning up and, you know, proning patients in the ICU and all that goes on. So, and then the other interesting split that happened here, and we got a pretty good explanation for that one, it was January, right? So the nurses and the non-nurses basically are sticking together. But all of a sudden, the respiratory therapists, the phlebotomists, are all of a sudden getting COVID at a higher rate, okay? And if you go back and look at our vaccination data, you can see that the nursing vaccine uptake was around 80%, just like the physicians in this data set, but not the ancillary personnel that were in front of the patients all the time. They were down in the 40s and 50s all the way into when we started pushing the mandates. So that was a big difference there, and they continued to accrue COVID antibodies as time went on. So that was that. So conclusions from that portion of this are, right, that the patient-facing healthcare workers about 40% more likely to seroconvert over the course of this year, and physicians were the least likely among the patient-facing healthcare workers to seroconvert. So kind of an interesting finding. A couple of things, you know, the Arizona numbers are an underestimate, but this is also an underestimate of seroprevalence in this group, right? Because I had attrition. So people who, you know, if you were ever positive, well, you were positive, right? But if you were negative and then you dropped out, I don't know what happened to you, okay? Right? So this is an underestimate of what our true accrual rate was. And then there's no ability here to directly compare because we didn't have a population, looking back, how would I have designed it? Yes, I would have totally wanted to go do, like, periodically, like, do some kind of sampling and look at the seroprevalence in the general population, but obviously logistically daunting with our limited funds and resources at the point in time. So anyway, so there was that. So then we started looking at our qualitative data, or quantitative data, excuse me. So, which I think is really interesting. And you guys all remember early on there was much like immunity is waning, or right, immunity is waning, or vaccine immunity is waning, right? Because antibody levels are falling. Well, that's what antibody levels do, right? Every infectious disease you can name where there's a vaccination, or you can track what happens to the antibody levels. They go up in response to vaccination or in response to the infection, and then they start to, and they tail off over time. So this is the way this was analyzed. So because people were positive at different times, so it's a little rough and not perfect, but it demonstrates the finding. So once you were positive, that was your month zero here. And then when you had another blood draw, that was your month three, right? So this, you kind of frame shift all the people into, you know, a month zero when you had your first positive. So, oops, got ahead of myself. Okay, so here was your median antibody level expressed in those arbitrary units, right? Was like 4.96, sorry. With the IQR you see there, and then on the third month, median was down to 2.32. down to 0.96, and then down to 0.6 by month 9. So an important walk away from this one is, right, what happens between month 3 and month 6? Okay, the median drops below the cutoff for the test. Okay, so for those people, if you had had your COVID more than 6 months ago, the IgG assay would say you were negative. Okay, if you get a qualitative answer out of that. So that's a very important point about why antibody testing is probably not all that helpful, especially if you are using a qualitative test. Okay, so the positive or negative, some little lateral flow test looking for COVID antibodies is not a good thing. So anyway, there's that. And then other point to make, not shocking with what we know about this, of our positives, about 10%, 12% had no, or asserted no prior symptoms. They were asymptomatic positives that had no idea they had COVID previously. You know, you plot this, it just makes, have to show up just because you never get a correlation like that. This is a simple, you know, exponential decay plot and with a ridiculous correlation coefficient, T1 half, half-life of your antibodies is about 3 months, which comports with everything you've seen elsewhere in literature, both spike antibody, nucleocapsid antibody, all decays, you know, over three, half-life about 3 months. So this, think about it, you know, you get down to a quarter or so of where you were, and it's time for your booster, right? So that's the six-month booster. It is right on the money. Back to the test positivity thing I was talking about. So, you know, everybody obviously is positive on the initial draw. That's how I found them. But by month 3, 72%, 35%, and then by month 9, less than a quarter of those people are still positive if you're doing qualitative antibody tests. So don't do that. Those are not helpful. Okay, that was test positivity. This is acting really squirrely. Okay, so our wellness score, so I only have, I apologize, I put the wrong slide in. This is one with 3 months. We have two more months. It's basically this constant stair step down. As you might expect, wellness scores have a massive spread. This is, analyzing these was not my forte to start with, and I've got some really good people who know what they're doing with this. But, you know, because you're like, that's not going to show any significance. But the people who, like, do wellness look at this and go like, wow, that's a lot, okay? And it's stair step down every month. Going down. Nothing terribly shocking about that. We're all less happy, I think. We're less well than we were at the beginning of all this. Interesting internally in the domains, it was the two big ones with the biggest fall were psychological and social, right? And I find the social one interesting, but it's the isolation of that. And, you know, you go back and you re-interview people and they're like, well, you know, it's social. It's not only social isolating because I was literally isolating for a long time, right? In this first year, especially, right? You're a healthcare worker. No one wanted to be around you, right? You were potentially Typhoid Mary. And, you know, and then you had the split in the public, right? You have family members who are like, I don't believe in this stuff, and I don't wear a mask, and you wear a mask, and that kind of thing. And it became very socially disruptive in so many ways. So and that's why I'm very interested to see taking another cut at this and see what it looks like, see what it looks like now a year later. So we're going to do this again in July. So that's a wellness score. So conclusions, we already talked about the first two, and then the you know the antibodies declining over time. You know, using any sort of seroconversion for cohorting in the hospital, making a decision about whether you should or shouldn't wear PPE, right? Oh, I've got antibodies, I'm immune, right? It's a bad idea. We don't know if that's a correlate of immunity or not. We don't have good solid data on whether a particular antibody level predicts risk of reinfection, right? How much of this is cell-mediated, you know, T-cell immunity, all of those things. So definitely more study is needed to look at that. And I want to close with one more picture. This one I always found very moving. This is your classic, to me, I won't say much. It speaks for itself. This is what we've been through. This is what our healthcare workers have been through. It's been a very hard time. There was a doctor in Idaho, in Idaho Falls, Dr. Krell. I don't know, maybe you've seen the little quote that got passed around last fall. He came into work one day and wrote a little message on the whiteboard. And I want to read that to close. It said, in the end, what sustains us and what we will remember about having survived this madness are the remarkable people who endured this with us, the best of humanity, all of us who demonstrated the best of our calling. We endured this together and supported each other. We saved lives, we lost lives, and we did both with compassion and competence, and we will not forget this. So I'll close with that. Thank you very much.